quora at Holden serves several different purposes. Sometimes we pick a socially controversial subject or something about which there's a wide range of opinion and debate those things. Last week we had a session on registration and the draft. Sometimes for the forum we might do it as a basic information session where folks just need to learn a whole lot more about something. About a week and a half ago we had a very good session on the handicap, which for a lot of us who haven't lived with the handicap was a very helpful kind of session. Tonight the forum will function as just a time of sharing on lifestyle changes, kind of do an inventory among the people who are here. Things that they've tried themselves, things that they've heard about, questions that we have. So it is a completely open session. I don't have much in the way of an agenda except that topic, lifestyle changes, what's happening where. What the reference is, when I say lifestyle, I mean things like alternative energy systems, maybe different kinds of housing and transportation, changes that people are making, changes of diet. I think of some of the things that are happening around the village. This past week, the solar panels went on the hospital roof to provide hot water by solar for the laundry. Warner has his worm farm where he's got worms working 3 8-hour shifts a day, composting their garbage and producing fine soil. There is a session later this week, Thursday morning, I think, at 10:45, where Werner Jansen will talk about the villages. Alternatives to such things as a heavy reliance upon diesel fuel, for example, or the fact that the soil around here isn't very conducive to growing a number of things, and so we have to work at producing better soil. Vince Mondette on Friday, I think at 4 o'clock, is going to have a session on building your own log cabin. I don't expect to be building my own log cabin. Some other folks might be. But let's just find out in the group here what kinds of things people are trying or have heard about. And then as each one is mentioned, if there are questions or comments from someone else, let's take care of it at the time. We'll just jump around. We don't have to do this by a certain set of ideas or changes. We can just jump around. Someone jump in, any place.
Yeah. We've done a couple of just small things. We raise some beef, and our own diet has changed to the point where we eat beef maybe once a week, so now what beef we do raise is sold. I had somebody mention the other day about beef requiring a lot of grain, but ours is strictly grass-fed. And no, consuming no grain. No feeds with growth stimulants, hormones, that kind of thing. My wife might tell you about her transportation situation.
I've been riding my bicycle to work and back for the last 2 years, leaving the car at home, and it's been really an exhilarating feeling, and probably the best part of the day in lots of cases.
Mm-hmm. How far?
It's about 9 miles.
Round trip. Mm-hmm. That's a significant change.
Yes.
From four wheels with a big engine to two wheels. You raised beef with grain before, and
we was finishing with grain. Uh-huh. Stopped doing that. It doesn't seem to make that much difference as far as working. We do it, you know, on a hobby scale, not on a commercial scale.
Yeah.
I'm sure if we were a commercial producer, where the balance of making a profit and not making a profit is very fine, it might be a different story. But in our situation, where we're using up land that otherwise is totally unproductive.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your different experiences with the bicycle. You said in some ways it's the best part of the day. What did you mean by that?
Well, when I first started to ride, I couldn't go down our driveway even. I just didn't have the energy to do it. It's been really a good feeling to build up enough energy and endurance to be able to do it. It's made me feel really good about myself. I think most of the things about the bike have been very positive. I've gotten three new ones out of it, which is very nice. I have, if they've just kind of taken care of things, I can do it myself kind of an attitude, I guess, maybe. But, and I kind of have an identity that I like, having to do with being kind of self-reliant, perhaps, or doing something that is outwardly visible as being a sign of trying to do something to help our society or to help our country.
Have other folks in your neighborhood done the same? I mean, is this something that's sort of catching on?
Not really catching on down there, but there are a lot more of us than there used to be, and we all wave at one another in a knowing smile. But, you know, we enjoy it. There are not a large number of people. I live in a small community in Southwest Washington. Now when we go to Seattle, there's an awful lot of people biking.
Maybe you relate to each other like people who had the first Volkswagen did. People who had the first Volkswagen bugs always waved at each other and smiled.
Yeah.
maybe the next set is the bicycle crowd doing the same thing.
It's kind of dangerous waving when you're trying to...
Yeah, no, don't do it. Don't do it.
There are some hazards. People don't share the road very well. And especially the farmers with their big trucks and the pickups and so on, and they'll often, you know, they will be rude in some place, and sometimes downright insolent, you know, trying to get you off as far as you can, or honking the horn as they go by, just, you know, to see what will happen. But most people are really very accepting of it, and often if I'll stop someplace, they'll say something. That they have a bike at home and they wish they could get started, but they haven't done it or something.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not as prepared for that as most European countries are, where you have a separate bicycle path along the main arteries.
I know,
which
it's
very handy,
yeah.
Very much safer.
Have you ever thought of taking bicycles up here to Holden for the rent or ride?
I don't know. What the best thing to think about.
Ride it down the lake.
Rent them on Lucerne and ride up to Holden. And you just take it on down with your luggage and your things. Yeah. Okay. Other item. Yes.
I faced a dilemma last year of what I was going to do with a furnace. I had an oil furnace, and of course everyone was saying, you know, oil is going to cost too much. And it was really interesting. In April, Lutheran Standard came out with an article that said if you had oil, don't change. You might, you know, improve on what you've got, but ultimately down the line, electricity was going to go up and gas was going to go up. And so I started pursuing, you know, what was I going to do with the oil furnace? And of course the oil people were pushing oil retention burners. And I have to say that I cut my oil usage down 2/3
by
an oil retention burner,
and
then we lowered our thermostat to 68. But I paid less this year at 90 cents a gallon than I had the year before at 55.
Just by lowering the thermostat and the technology.
And improving on the furnace.
Yeah.
So the investment I put into it, I got back, and I'm now using less fuel than my friends who have gas for the same amount of space.
Without doing other things like insulation around the house, windows and doors.
I already have that. You know, but it's something you really have to look into all the alternatives rather than just assuming, well, oil, you know, is on its way out.
Uh-huh.
It's how you use it.
What is an oil retention burner?
Yeah, what is an oil retention burner?
It burns at something like 2,500 degrees. It's a double burner of some sort. Now, I'm not mechanically minded, you know. I mean, I can't even fix my own plumbing. But it burns at such a high heat that when it comes off, of course, the forced air, it takes much less fuel to burn, you know, to heat your house to the same amount of the same temperature. And you notice it immediately. You can notice your house is so much warmer. In fact, there was no way we could have lived with our thermostat at 72. We have been driven right out the doors. But, you know, as you men would understand it, if you look into it, because I would try to get into mechanics.
Is the information generally available?
Yes, it's available to all oil dealers.
Other items on energy matter?
It's really great that they would come up with something like that. On the other hand, it's really terrible that for 30 years we've been burning oil and poof like that. When something like this, we could have 2/3 more reserves of heating oil than we have at this point because it just wasn't economic. What else are we squandering now that 20 years down the road somebody doesn't have a way to use it?
I don't think it's think of even as much as just kept withheld.
Yeah. Other items on energy alternatives? Yes?
My husband has put a wood burning furnace in his shop. He heats that totally with wood. We live and have a large grove that is quite old and has much dead wood in it. Had a tornado go through it last year, which fell a great deal of wood, and his wood to last for many years.
Mary?
We discovered that our electric bill, 40% of it was our hot water heater. We turned it down considerably. And really saved a lot of electricity and a lot of money. This was in West Virginia. And now we have friends that have bought blankets or jackets to put on the hot water.
Yes.
And that also.
Yes, there are quite a lot of heat is lost.
Along with that hot water heater, my folks have an electric one, and what they do is when they go to bed at night, they just turn it off completely. And when they get up in the morning, turn it back on, and the water stays warm enough so that they can take showers in.
In Europe, they have hot water heaters in separate parts of the house. You have a hot water heater in the kitchen and another one for the bathroom. And they're set on timers, so they only go on at particular times when there would be usage. And they're much smaller tanks, of course, than what we have here.
Anyone here working with solar heating and cooling? Brian?
There's a Lutheran church down in southern Idaho, which is this time applied to the Department of Energy for a grant to put in to convert one of their south wall into a passive solar heating system for part of their building. And all they're doing is so painting the wall black and putting some holes in the bottom and at the top, putting in plexiglass or something, looking into what sort of cover over that. And that's their basic heating for half their building. And that's the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something very simple like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's being done down there with the church.
Mm-hmm.
Linda?
I don't know a lot about solar heating, but my father and brother built a solar heater for our basement, so in the winter we heat it that way.
Oh, yeah. So, John?
We have two people who come up to the village. Neither of them are here this week. I think Dwayne Kohler, the architect, is coming perhaps next week. Doug Bolin, B-O-L-Y-N, I think, has a tape and has been here a couple times. I would recommend that tape to you especially. The idea that it's very complicated, technical, that you'll have big things on your roof or tons of rock to store and circulating pumps, and when that's the first image, I think that's too bad. Doug's premise is passive solar. In other words, the way you build your house, the way you face your house, the southern exposure, the use of materials in the living room, either with a brick or stone wall that might run down the middle, or the floor itself being stone, insulation, drapes that are now worth 3.5 inches of insulation, the trees around the outside in the summer, you could save 50%. No matter what other way you heat your house, you can save 50% of your heating bill by building your house a certain way. Then when everyone says, we've already built our house, he says, then you can add to it, essentially, a greenhouse or adapt it and save considerable fuel. It's a very, very fine take. Informal talk in here with questions, but very helpful.
On that one, in Spokane area, they're starting to experiment with the underground houses. That were 3 parts of it was underground, and also with the solar plating in the roof. And they face it so it gets most of the sunshine during the day.
Mm-hmm. Reston, Virginia has a high school. I think it's the high school. It's one of the large schools that's about 2/3 of the building is underground. And that's, well, it's been functioning about 5 years now and works.
There's a school up in Idaho built the same way in elementary school. Built under, about 3/4 under the ground and facing.
Maybe we'll start putting the churches on underground. We're going to go underground again. So back to the beginnings. Was there a hand in the back? Yes.
To say,
speak loudly enough. Yeah.
In Northfield, a man built a house which has been touted as the most energy efficient house in the country. And he used passive solar. And he said if he did it again, he wouldn't invest in the solar. He would rather look at construction and site selection as being the two most important criteria. And one of his partners then built a house last year close to where we live. And he used 2x8 studs. He wanted to get 2x12s, but the bank didn't loan him enough money to go that thickness. But he used 2x8s and very good insulation and use of windows, the facing of the house, sloping roofs, and his total heating bill was under $100. This is in Minnesota. And he said
my
the
goodness.
Site selection and the use of the materials, thick walls and good insulation, are what will save rather than an expensive solar system, although that, you know, is an alternative.
Yes, right.
Putting schools underground for energy saving may be counterproductive. Most energy in schools is not putting heat into it. It's taking the heat generated by the body of the pupils out. And a light. The light and the pupils heat the building than the air conditioning.
Pardon me if I'm eating my ice cream. I stood in line a long time here for this. My wife did. So.
Energy saving.
Yeah. This is an alternative to a cone that was in a dish.
Seattle Foundation is putting up a new building in Spokane. I believe it's 18 stories. And they're almost their total source of heat to heat the building will be from their lights. And by structuring the lights in certain positions and then exactly deciding how many bodies are going to work in each work area, they hope to get along without having to add heat, except on a very cold day.
Bears up what you're in.
Just as an aside to that, my brother-in-law is looking into underground homes to build, hopefully in the future. The figure, I guess, is about 17% of the heat in an average home comes from, or in a home that's built, with that in mind, comes from the bodies, the people living there. 17%, which surprised me.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought it that high. John?
One of the things in the United States is the amount of cubic footage that we now think is necessary. One of the things about other cultures, I think Japan, for instance, body heat and small heaters and the use of having all of your legs under the same table or something, and but the cubic footage of small rooms is simply culturally acceptable, and it isn't here. We have lots of space.
That was striking for us when we were on sabbatical leave. I read those statistics before we went about standards of living which were a match for those in the United States, like Switzerland or West Germany or Sweden, and where the per capita energy consumption was one third of that of the United States, or up to one half, or the Japanese about one fourth. And we're still talking about roughly the same standard of living. I couldn't wonder what was the reason, and one of the major reasons is that it's simply the space factor. I mean, the rooms are as, a house is one third as large, or half as large. And when we came home last summer and walked into our house, that was a case of culture shock. We have an enormous house, and it wasn't that enormous when we left. But you get accustomed to it, and after a while it begins to feel cozy, and it's less to care for, and just lots of dementias.
I was just
going to
say, along with that, the European custom or culture of not having one family dwellings, I think, really saves a lot of energy, because we have some German friends that I visited over there, and they live in a kind of an apartment thing. And, you know, over here we think if you're really well-to-do, you have to have your own house, you know. And now with condominiums and stuff, that's changing maybe, but I think that really makes a difference, having multiple families.
Now, even in a place like the Netherlands, which is one of the most densely populated patches of real estate in the world, people do not have suffer all sorts of afflictions that come from living so close together. You would think with that kind of density you'd have real problems, but it can be done. You don't need the kind of space that we're accustomed to. Yes, Cheryl.
I have a friend right now, Dr. Edmund Rosen, John Benton, and he's working for a project that John Denver funded in Snowmass, Colorado, and I just happen to bring the brochure. But
you're the local representative.
But the project is only like 2 years old right now, but the whole thing is geared around living in harmony with the environment, and it's not necessarily focused on self-sufficiency. But it's just a really neat idea, and I went there last year, and it was still kind of in the planning stages. He calls it the dream of a bunch of grown-up hippies. But it's just really neat. They're trying to build a facility, and like the housing, it's like what you're talking about. I don't know if you can see it, but it's all underground, and it's passive solar based on the sun. And they're going to try to use this as a meeting of the minds for people to gather together to talk of new kinds of technologies and how we can live on this earth without destroying it, while like living without really taking from it as much as, you know, and giving back the same amount. And then they're also going to try to become like an educational facility and a communication center for other people to learn, come there and learn, and then go out and then teach in their own communities how to be more energy efficient. But it's just a really neat idea, and if anyone wants to look at the brochure, they can.
I have a question. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, has anybody done anything in their churches with energy saving? Particularly, my internship congregation was considering the possibility of putting in those giant fans that slowly turn around to take the hot air off the really high sloping ceiling. But the question that they had was that the church is only heated one day a week on Sunday, and would it be economical to put the fans in just for that, and would it help in the summertime, and would it take more energy to run them than it was worth, and stuff like that. Has anybody done anything
yet? The DLCA, the Division of Missions North America, was a Vision Parish Service as well, to send out a couple of books for property committees to look and evaluate their buildings. Suggestions were simply planting bushes around, which would help provide some insulation, cut down the wind, chill factor, and so forth. Looking at door space and window space and what sorts of little things like that So there are some things being suggested on that. Church is being talked about, the design of that in, well, I mentioned the one already, which is already built, and then the other, another one, which is in their just being formed a congregation, and they're looking at building, starting to think about what building might be and coming into some of that. So there are some suggestions being done for them.
There are some materials that are available, and there are books now.
Oh, I know. Yeah, we got those.
Churches and so on.
We couldn't figure
National
out.
Council of Churches.
I was wondering if anybody had done it.
Yeah, there was a hand back here. Is
yeah,
there?
I just finished spending a year in West Texas, where the wind never ceases. Everybody has decorative windmills, and now there's a kind of a campaign on television to try to get people to connect those to something instead of just saying, isn't it wonderful to have a windmill? And, or sometimes you see them out in the farms pumping water for cattle, but not, you know, not to produce any electricity as such. And so I don't know whether this is in other states, but they've got a plan now where you can produce your own electricity by whatever means you want to, but particularly windmill. You can write for information how to get the best windmill for your area or your home. And if you produce more than is needed, the power system of companies have to buy back your excess electricity. And I don't know how the other states would react to that, but I think it'd be kind of fun.
It's true here.
Is it true?
Yeah, turn your meter back.
Yeah.
Send it back the other way. There's a dentist who comes up to Holden, and when he's here and the wind's blowing, his meter's going backwards, he's always delighted.
So. Does anyone here use methane tanks for generating gas to cook with? I'm a little surprised.
Happening down in our area, it's not anything personal about it, but there are three gas haul plants going in. One of them is going to be producing gas haul using thermal energy out of the ground. They're in the process of searching for various. They've looked several places, but where I happen to be in an area of thermal energy, that they're looking at a resource to build up there. Another concern in our area, since we're a place of irrigation, is the use of water. And how can you keep expanding, taking land for housing, which is prime farmland, and pushing farms higher and higher into farther and farther into marginal lands, and then trying to develop water systems to make that land arable for agriculture. And that's land use planning is a major concern in terms of lifestyle.
Well, the water table has been dropping in several agriculturally important states.
Along the way of churches saving energy, I read recently, I'm sure that many others have too, possibly some you haven't, about churches in a community, different denominations or different churches sharing their facility and shutting down one of the facilities and using the other one to greater capacity during the heating months. And then maybe the next year alternating. And that way you're only heating one sanctuary and just a matter of scheduling and so on.
Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating book, both the library and the bookstore, called The Integral Urban House, for those that live in the city. It was one of three houses in the United States that Berkeley has put together. They took an old row house and made it completely self-sufficient with solar energy, a Swedish composting toilet. They have rabbits in the backyard and fish, and it's just a very narrow plot. So they raise the protein for their, source of protein comes from fish and rabbits. They compost and show you how to build compost bins that are in three sections for a very small area. They have honeybees for their honey. It's just a fun book to look at. I don't think many of us would ever go into it in great detail, but it's got a lot of really nice ideas for people living in the city that would like to live a different way.
Well, we have friends in the city who raise chickens in a garden on top of their garage and the back deck. It's fun, but although there is something a little, it's not really unsettling, but when the person goes out in the back and gets a chicken and brings it in, and then you have it for dinner that same night. People doing things in transportation other than the bicycles?
There's an electric car.
Electric cars? Are there some around?
There's one in our town.
Oh.
Well, maybe like in a small town, parking centrally and doing a lot of walking to the train instead of getting in the driving.
Larry, why don't you mention what you do in D.C. with transportation?
Four families own two cars together, rather than each of the four families had a car before. And we decided that our schedules were such that it could be arranged to have fewer cars and still meet our transportation needs. We could use public transportation to a degree that we hadn't been using it. The insurance costs were going higher and higher in the city, as well as the basic cost of the cars itself, both to purchase and to run. So we organized this in such a way that we jointly purchased the cars, the two cars, and then we log in the miles that we drive, so that when I get in the car, I take a look at the speedometer, and I log in what the mileage, and then when I am finished, then I write down the mileage again. And I think most recently we're charging 20 cents a mile. It's actually cost more than that now for both cars to drive more than 20 cents a mile. But we purchased the cars together, so that cost is shared, and then from there on, we pay according to use, so that, and it works fine. We wouldn't do differently now.
What about vacations?
It just hasn't been a problem as long as people mention it ahead of time. It hasn't been a problem. A lot of errands can be done with one person taking the car and doing errands for the other families, like shopping, for example.
Do you live close to each other?
Yeah, we live within walking distance to each other. And then we each have a set of keys for the cars. And we have lots of fun sort of joking about it. We tell our friends, here's a set of keys, walk around the neighborhood until you find a car that it fits. Because we're forever walking around the neighborhood looking for the car, although we're close enough that we can usually find it. And there's more junk in our garage now because we don't have the car in there. Space and things like that. But it works fine. You find yourself combining errands, as I mentioned, which saves some time for the other folks. You find yourself organizing your errands so that you do them when you have the car, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 errands, instead of getting in the car every time it occurs to you that you need to do something. So we discovered that we drove one-third the mileage after going into the car co-op that we did before. And we didn't have a sense that we were deprived. It just was a better job of scheduling the use of the time that we had the car and using public transportation. I did bicycle for a while. I live 3 miles from where I teach, and tried bicycling for a while, and between being nearly asphyxiated by the city buses and being crowded between the buses and the cars parked in the parking lane, and nearly being squeezed in there a couple of times, I put that aside and I walked to work and back now, which is fine too. So, public transportation, more exercise, and less mileage with the cars have been the outcome of that arrangement.
Are there any teenagers in any of those families?
That's a good question. There aren't yet. Yeah, that may be a problem with that. But I think we'll recommend that the teenagers have their own carpool lane.
I know a guy that has learned how to ride his bike in such a way that in Oregon we have cans that you get 5 cents for, so he can ride to work and reach down and pick up the cans alongside the road and put them in a little bag on his bike.
So
he makes enough money with the cans he picks up to buy new tires for his bike.
My goodness.
But he has a gas to pull before he figured out how to
Now I picked up the can to pay his hospital bill.
He told me that. He hasn't gotten too hurt lately. He does all right. So.
I was just going to say,
your comment about the discovery that after you started sharing cars, that you were more efficient about errands, got more exercise, all this sort of thing. That's what's so exciting about so many of the lifestyle changes that all of us are trying to make. Everybody's trying different things. You think you're going to sacrifice something, but then it turns in that you find a new benefit that was so much better than the way before. Yeah. And I've discovered that in the biking to school, I bike between two schools, and I really feel that I'm a more effective teacher because I have that breathing space when I refresh myself and I come in and I'm feeling really exhilarated after being out in the fresh air. And when I first started, I was thinking of, you know, giving up driving. And it turned out then for a while we only had one bike between Ben and me, and we used to argue about who got to ride the bike to school and who had to take the car. So now that's the preferred.
Yes. Yeah, even walking to work rather than driving, I find very helpful because it takes me almost an hour. And it's a nice time to sort of prepare for the day and at the end of the day to kind of relax and sort of debrief. Whereas before, if you go during rush hour, I took the bus most of the time, but if I would drive, you spend most of the time being angry with the person in front of you.
A benefit came to my classroom too. We began to recycle aluminum, and with 20 or 30 children collecting aluminum, we really got quite a bit, and then we were able to have parties throughout the year to celebrate our collections. And, you know, it was an insight to the children that this was something that they could do and begin to save, to recycle. A lot of them had never considered it. So recycling was.
Al Pitcher, who has been up here on faculty several different times, helped organize the recycling center in the church to which he belonged. And it was a fine idea because it was once a week. Same folks, or pretty much the same crowd, coming to a central location. You know, the church is an excellent place. He said it was fun, although a little bit strange the first Sunday they did it, because they worked a liturgy around it, and everybody brought their trash into the sanctuary by the altar to inaugurate the recycling center. But now, every week, everybody brings their trash to church. It's a great, great idea. Central location, regular. It's a community project. I would underscore what Betty said about benefits. Oftentimes, there are benefits in terms of just human relations. I think a very important book of almost 10 years ago now is the one by Philip Slater called The Pursuit of Loneliness. And Slater says that, he's a sociologist, says that his findings are such that American homes tend to actually end up causing people to have fewer and fewer daily meaningful contacts by being increasingly self-sufficient, what we say is self-sufficient. So that you've got a washer and a dryer for your laundry, you've got telephone, you've got all you need in order to, Well, you really don't have to leave the house except to go get some more goods. You don't have to leave the house in order to get done what you need to do. And then he says, when the budget allows, then the kids get even separate items for their own rooms, whether it's stereo systems or televisions or telephones, etc. The fewer and fewer and fewer meaningful daily contacts where people are dependent upon one another. And that is a pursuit of loneliness. And it's directly related to being supposedly self-sufficient. Well, I think what happens with a lot of the alternatives that require sharing or that build the sharing in is that you just simply have much more day-to-day contact with people and you find yourself not wanting to do it differently. I mean, we have people in our little church that share laundry facilities. Well, it's just, believe it or not, more fun chatting with somebody over laundry that's a good friend than doing it all by yourself. So instead of having washer and dryer in each place, they agree that the washer and dryer will be over at somebody's house and then three families will use it. Yeah, Mary?
Well, just another example that Mary Ellen Ross that just left today that was on staff teaches at St. Olaf, and she said six single people get together two or three times a week for an evening meal. Not that they have to stay there the whole evening, but there's that contact with one another. It saves you from cooking and eating by yourself three nights a week.
Yeah.
Churches that have food co-ops find that suddenly, you know, fellowship becomes much more real. There's a sense of community, and it's a rare church that wouldn't allow a food co-op in the basement. I think that's something that all congregations could do. You get better food. It's not a way to save money, although you do, but most of the churches that I know that do that, the money they save goes to Bread for the World or Lutheran World Relief. It's a way of looking beyond themselves, and it just gets people together.
Sure, you bring your trash and take home whole wheat.
Just when you're speaking of laundry, that also ends up saving things in a lot of other ways, because right now I live in a really little town and I have to drive 22 miles or so to wash my clothes. That's the nearest laundry. So this whole process makes me be very careful about how often I do have to wash clothes and how big my loads are, you know, and I think that that's something. My other friends who have washers in their apartments wash, you know, a pair of pants if they wear it a few hours, and I'll wear it a couple of their times, you know, and I'll wash out a lot of things by hand, which would not be practical for a family, but it works for me, you know. And there are a lot of other things that you have to do something like that you realize you can save on. You know, you save on all the water and the heat for water and all kinds of things. Plus, going to a laundromat is a whole subculture by itself. It's
very. Depends what time you go. one of the problems that I think the lifestyle changes brings into how our economy is set up.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about our own saving, but how many? The economy is set up on producing things so that you buy your 24-foot extension lighter that you may use once a year to put up your Christmas lights, or twice a year to take them down, I guess. And then, and I buy mine, and how often do I use mine, or some other sorts of things. And yet, there's a company there producing them at 100 a day so that everybody can have their 24-foot extension lighter. And I think that raises some real hard questions for me as to how do we adjust our lifestyle, and we're doing all sorts of little things here, and yet maintain, we're talking about an economic system that needs to be adapted to that. When we talk about housing starts, and I think about all that land being used by all those housing starts, we keep having to build new houses. And then how that just works its way through the economy, or cars, or whatever. Then it becomes, the whole question starts to be much more difficult for me. I can grow my own vegetables, but then what's that say about getting into some of the real issues of my alternative lifestyle?
When we were on the way here, we passed through Montana, we drove through the state of Montana and stopped at a shopping center. And a guy was handing out information on, they're trying to get it so that the people in Montana can own their own utilities. And one of the, I think the laws that is existing in Montana right now is that the people do have a choice if they're going to build new power facilities at all. The people have a choice where they can say whether or not that that's, you know, if they can find another alternative that is better than the one that is proposed, you know, they can vote it down. And one of the things that they had discovered was that they wanted to build a new nuclear power plant or add on to one or cement that, and they wanted, it would cost $2 billion. And they did a bunch of research on it and discovered that the $2 billion could go to, and the nuclear power plant would go to 16,000 person years of employment. He said if that same money was put towards things like solar energy and wind generating and, you know, insulating houses and all that kind of stuff, they could get out of that $2 billion, 64,000 person.
Back to recycling again, we found that, this is kind of dumb, but we don't go to the dump more than about once every 6 months, whereas most people get their trash picked up once a week. With the recycling that we do, between recycling the glass and the aluminum and the metal and the compost pile, we have almost no garbage. And that's made, you know, it's kind of a hassle. And for a while, when we had a babysitter coming in, she just had the most horrible time in the world trying to figure out what to do with our garbage. But once you get used to it, it's really not bad, and all of that is reused one way or another.
And another way to recycle is, like, if you start at Goodwill or Salvation Army for things that you need, that I furnished entire kitchens, and certainly for children's clothing, and there's very little that you can't find at Goodwill or Salvation Army. Yeah. Well, that kind of bothers me, garage sales, because I don't know whether it's true or not, but it seems like in some cities that Goodwill is folding because everybody's having garage sales instead of bringing their things to Goodwill. And I think they do a pretty neat job of letting people have employment to fix things up.
But small towns don't have Goodwill.
Some of the large
towns are very costly. More ways than one. I have to live in a tiny town, and my garage is the Goodwill Center. And it is full about, okay, the garage that I rent along with my apartment takes up, you know, two-thirds of the space in the little building, and there's a large space there. And that fills up, I would say, every 2 to 3 months. And a Goodwill truck comes and picks it up. And people bring stuff all the time there. And that's only a little town of 700 people. So it does exist in the little town.
Just not all of them. We have no access to Goodwill or any of that kind of thing.
Is there some wisdom from 10, 20, 30 years ago that we need to learn again? I'd just be curious, from those of you who are a generation older than myself, of things that you used to do that now look like wise moves to make.
Let me give you a perspective on that, Larry. I think one of the most things I've been most impressed with in the last few years is the way my brother, a younger man who's trying to learn how to farm in Alaska, has recycled people. And his idea is that there are several young people who live together out on this land, and they're trying to learn how to farm. And the recycling involves going to the pioneer home in the nearby town and bringing old farmers out Sunday afternoon meals. They're learning about farming and providing a wonderful kind of social experience for some people who thought maybe they weren't as useful as they had been. And it's been delightful to think about the folks that they've learned from, you know, equipment repair, farming, sewing, a variety of different ways.
recycling people, recycling information. And that's something that I wish more people would think about.
Yeah.
Also, for parents who think Christmas toys are very expensive, I offered the recreation summer program for 2 years and I had no finances in the way of buying equipment to use. And so you can create bowling sets with half-gallon milk cartons painted in like happy bubble sand. You can take bottles and save popsicle sticks and have the kids try to drop them into bottles. You can take Coke bottles and old embroidery hoops and have toss games and stacking up cans for target practice. There's a lot of things you can do, the things that you just throw away, making stilts with the cans and old ropes, and taking hoses and making hoops from kids. So that's another way of just recycling things that you think are useless.
Speaking along the lines of what Nan back there said, I believe I read an article or was told about with the economic stress today and how people are having to cope with the recession and inflation and all the other problems. Those that have lived through the Depression are being sought out to help counsel people now that are having a great deal of trouble coping with today's problems, and their resources and their means to survive in the 30s are now being used as resources to help today's problems.
How is that done?
I can't remember exactly what it was. I know it involves some kind of counseling sessions or just talking with people that are in need of, mm-hmm. of learning how to.
Yes.
In fact, that I've had this weekend.
I wonder if folks would be interested in hearing about Meredith Olson, a friend who worked here at Holden on the trout project, where there were some trout in the pool up here, and now she works out of Wright County Community Action near Buffalo, Minnesota, working with small farmers trying to raise fish in farm ponds or ponds that they had on their property that were nothing more than livestock ponds. And last year, the project is experimental, but working with sunfish especially, it seems like there's some hope for raising a little extra protein, maybe making a little bit more money or diversifying the income sources on the farm. And in Minnesota, we have lots of small lakes and ponds that are suitable for raising fish. And sunfish can be obtained when they're quite small. They're 2 ounces or so. And by the end of one growing season, might weigh a half a pound or more. And one problem with small ponds is the problem of winter kill, where under ice cover, under winter, oxygen is used up and the fish die. But this might be solved because you can start with new fish every year. You don't have a problem with carryover and your ponds becoming sort of fish.
Anyone have any more ideas or things you've tried with respect to food? Changes of diet or food production?
I've been thinking about this when you're talking about food, is I'm kind of trying to figure out when I'm hungry and when to stop eating and when I'm full. And I never really thought about it. And when I started it, I couldn't tell when I was hungry. I just ate at 6. I didn't know if I was hungry or not. I really didn't. And then it's really been helpful. And then I don't have to think about it. I know when I'm full. And I didn't know when I was full. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't tell. And I like that. I'm short and I gain weight fast. So I didn't want to get really heavy. It's been very interesting. I couldn't tell when I to quit eating. I just figured it out.
I'd like to ask, what is the result of that? Now, do you not eat some meals then when you're not hungry, or what's it?
Yeah, I just kind of stop. Well, you do get hungry at certain times, but if I'm not hungry, I don't eat.
It's hard to be an individual, but if you have a family,
that's
a different thing.
But it's also hard to quit once you start.
There was a hand here.
I grew up in the Depression times, and there were many times that I was hungry. And my folks, my dad always gave us, in the wintertime, a spoonful of dry sulfur. And if you took it without gagging, then you got a spoonful of sugar. And then in the spring, we always had sassafras tea. And we drank a lot of Cambridge tea. Now, how many know what Cambridge tea is? That's hot water with two sugars in it. And we were never sick. Never sick.
What was the sulfur for?
Well, it was supposed to keep us from having colds and stuff and thicken our blood. And then in the spring, we drank sassafras tea. Now, this was my parents. And we just never had a doctor in the house.
Just in case you're sick. Solvent molasses in the spring to thin the blood.
Is that right? It is 10 o'clock. Yeah, we can just take if there are a couple more, that's fine. Then there's we'll have a short break, and those who would like to stay, there is Compline here at 10:15. A couple other items on energy, yeah, Jenny?
I was just going to say something about food. We've been gradually changing our diet over the past 7 years and moving towards a vegetarian diet. And when we first started getting into it, I was so worried about whether we'd all get enough protein, especially the children. And so I was, always really being very careful, make sure enough protein and all this. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized we just get so much more protein than we need. I mean, most Americans. That now what I'm trying to work on is trying for us not to consume more than we need each day, because we can't store protein. What's if it's not used during that first? I don't know how many hours it is, but within a day, does not stay protein. And so it's a very big waste in our diet to consume more protein than you need. So we're working on just consuming the amount that we need for the day.
John?
Fritz Norstedt was the director here just before I came, and came from the Lutheran Hospital in Chicago, and also has traveled in other countries a lot on world hunger. And he speaks about us taking in too much protein, same thing that he just said. He has a memorable way of saying that, at least I never forget. He says, in the United States, we have the most expensive urine in the world.
Everybody listen through a microscope.
Takes pictures.
Yes. A good source of ideas and find out what kind of experiments are being done in this whole area is the Organic Gardening magazine. They're always into strange new ideas, and some of them are practical and some of them are pretty frivolous.
Maybe we should finish just by naming some resources. That might be a helpful way to do it. That's one. Mary has several books in the bookstore, both on food and also on energy, right?
We have a whole section on alternatives.
Yeah.
And how to live better on less and voluntary simplicity.
There are a lot of free government publications coming out now that are available.
Our power utility offers to do an audit of the home and provides materials on such things as insulation and other saving things. And so the public utilities are a place to go.
We had the public utility come and audit our church facility to help us areas where we might attempt to make a building more energy efficient.
I like that book for resources, that little publication that the ALC put out called A Community of Stewards. I've used that a little bit in the congregation, really like that. It's just a skinny little, not a pamphlet, but a booklet. It's a good size to use in churches, I think.
Yeah, it's geared for the churches. Yeah.
The ALC has a new one out, too, in conjunction with the Omega Commission on uses of energy. It just came out this afternoon.
Oh.
Must be your book.
No, not the energy official. Other resources?
It's in the bookstore, but one of the things that I'm really concerned about is alternative celebrations. And I think that's a really important area for all of us. I know our family, we eat too much when we get together.
Oh yes, the Foxfire series, sure. There are about 5 volumes of that. Right now, I think. Yeah.
I think
it's
a cookbook called Laurel's Kitchen that's based on a community of people who live together and want to eat well together. It's good to begin with because it contains good philosophy as well as good nutritional information and charts, and helps a beginner find out how to balance amino acids and how to make change, and then all the recipes. So I think that's sort of a good, I use that as my basic workflow.
It's called Laurel's?
Laurel's Kitchen. It's in the bookstore.
Yes.
Another good book that I take to supermarkets with me is called The Supermarket Handbook. And with Nikki and David Goldbeck, they just list brand names and tell you what is really a good brand name and what just has a lot of junk in it. Their theory is that you don't have to go to a health food store to get good food. In fact, it's probably expensive and not such a good idea. So they say go to your supermarket, and these things are available, and they divide them up into Midwest, East, and West Coast with the brand names. So you can just take it and read it as you shop in the grocery store. I found it very helpful.
How do generics rate in that, you know?
Pardon?
How do the generic brand that keeps coming out that's starting to be a new brand name?
I don't think they listed any generic brands. You mean like if it just says cake
macaroni.
Mix at Albertsons or something and you don't...
It's a new brand name on the market.
No. Or just beer and
in a congregation, we might think of doing a kind of inventory and then creating a sort of bank of skills, where instead of always hiring services from someone whom you may or may not know, you trade services among people you do know, so that your plumber friend is willing to come and fix your plumbing, and in exchange for that you do something that you're good at. That sort of skills bank can be done among people you know.
Professional people can't do that, though, can they? Like a lawyer, a dentist, and stuff. No,
I
do that.
There's something that you can't get in trouble. That's called the underground economy, and they're so concerned about that these days because it's growing.
I asked one of a man about that, but he said only one sermon a week was enough.
Yeah, what would the clergy do with that?
go and say a prayer, maybe.
Really, what you're saying is what this man over here referred to earlier is that many things we've been saying are really undermining the present economy.
we're subversives.
I'm not sure that's all bad.
To the friendly colony. No, I'm not saying that it's all bad either, but I think we better be aware of that.
Yeah. One thing we have, yes.
And you got a plumber in your congregation who's trying to earn a living plumbing, and you find enough handyman around who can do his work.
Yeah.
He's gonna. You're not gonna have much to do. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot involved here.
Yes.
That we're talking about.
Yeah, and we haven't explored those dimensions. Those dimensions of how it would affect the larger systems. I think there might be a couple of responses to that. One is that ours is certainly has been a consumption-oriented economy, and with specializations in the services sectors. And where there's a monetary value attached to all of those things. But the other thing is that we're in some areas at least, we're certainly entering a time of transition. We know that we've got to make some basic changes in energy systems, for example. And while we'll certainly stumble and probably do a lot of muddling through, with some kind of wise planning, you don't necessarily have increased unemployment. I mean, in making the transition to something else, you can concentrate on it being more labor intensive. But it is subversive of the kind of consumption-oriented economy that we've had going. And I think those consequences of even these little acts need to be considered well. I do not see in them a justification for not making the transition. I mean, that seems to me to be a kind of a madness. Well, it is time for comment. Thank you.